All right, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. A reminder as to our schedule. So, as you know, I've been quite the traveler these days, which is very unusual for me. So out of 4 weeks, starting the April 9th, I've been traveling. We'll have been traveling out of 3 out of the 4 of them, which is very unusual. So next week is one of those weeks for me. So we will meet today, and we will actually finish the book of Job today. There are some chapters we're largely going to skip over, and I'll explain to you why when we get there. And so we'll get to the end of Job today. And then our last meeting about Job, though, will be in 2 weeks from today. And my intention is that having finished Job today, we'll have some time to think about how all of that sits with us in terms of our questions about why bad things happen to good people, and come together for our last meeting in 2 weeks just to kind of have a conversation about where this all leaves us. Because as Richard Rohr also points out in his book, and as I have experienced in Bible studies before, most people, when they get to the book of Job, find it utterly unsatisfying. You imagine people who read Job for the very first time, and it's been advertised to them that that this book is about why bad things happen to good people, and they're very excited to have an answer to that. And so they get to the end of the book and discover that they have no answer, and they just want to throw the Bible across the room, which isn't appropriate, so both people don't do that. But we have to reckon with that. We have to reckon not just with what we've learned as we've traveled through the book, but we have to reckon with how the book ends and how that sits in our own lives. So when we last left Job, a long time ago it seems like, we had just finished chapter 28. And Job was in the middle of a speech, in which he's still in the middle, which was a response to yet another round of harassment, yes, haranguing from his friends, who have proven to be rather useless in terms of helping him sort of understand what it is that's happening to him. And that chapter 28 had been a kind of poetic riff on the way in which wisdom is so difficult for human beings to access. So we pick up today in chapter 29, where Job is continuing his speech in response to his friends. But in chapter 29, it takes a bit of a turn, because Job transitions in the midst of this chapter from the speech that he is giving in response to his friends to making what amounts to his final defense of himself before God. So remember that over the course of this book, Job has kind of transitioned into this place where he has demanded to meet God in court, right? In order to have a full accounting of what exactly he's guilty of, and in order to have the opportunity to assert his innocence. Job has acknowledged, however, that there is an inherent problem with this, because, first of all, to have God appear in court means that God appears as his accuser, but God is also the judge, and therefore the system is rigged, as it were. And there is the additional problem that whatever God does is by definition just, because that is who God is. And so that creates an interesting conundrum for Job. But this courtroom sort of metaphor persists, and it comes to its climax really at this point. And in Job's time, we are accustomed in our legal system to having a lawyer make a final defense of the client. And in fact, in our system, whoever is accused of something is not obligated to testify. That is their choice. They can't be compelled to say anything in court. That is their choice. Or their choice upon their lawyer's recommendation. In Job's time, the way these things were done is it was customary for the person accused of something to give a final defense of himself. And this was not done by some kind of lawyer. This was done by you. And so this is the model that Job is operating on. So very quickly in chapter 29, we transition to Job sort of giving his final defense. So at the beginning of chapter 29, it says, Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, when I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was still with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were washed with milk and the rock poured out for me streams of oil, when I went out to the gate of the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose up and stood. The nobles refrained from talking and laid their hands on their mouths. The voices of princes were hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths." So at the beginning of this chapter, Job is recalling the life he used to have, right? And
I've had somewhat the same thoughts.
Yeah, we all do at certain points in our lives, right? Oh, if we were only young again, right? But notice that the thing that stands out in Job's remembrance of his earlier life is in verse 2, where he says, "Oh, as things were in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me." And again in verse 5, when it says, when the end of verse 4, when it says, "The friendship of God was upon my tent, and when the Almighty was still with me." And so while Job remembers several things here, like when he used to be respected by people, and people paid attention to what he had to say, the thing he chiefly remembers in this chapter, at the beginning of this chapter, is his friendship with God. And remember that it is the seeming loss of this friendship that troubles Job the most throughout this book. And it is the thing that his friends simply cannot understand, right? They are all operating under the assumption that what has made Job sad is the loss of his stuff, the loss of his wealth, the loss of his health. They're assuming that this is what troubles Job the most, because it is what would trouble them. But what we learn about Job as this book progresses is that, in fact, it's not so much the loss of these things that troubles him. It is the apparent loss of his friendship with God, that the closeness he experienced with God seems to have withdrawn from him. Because remember, the first time Satan is allowed to touch him, Job loses all kinds of stuff, right? And he remains faithful. He doesn't curse God or rebel against what's happened or anything. And then it's when he loses his health that things begin to take a turn. But it is also in that moment that Job begins to wonder what has happened to his relationship with God, and it seems to him that God has somehow stepped away from him. Now his friends are all trying to say, "No, it's you who stepped away from God because you sinned, and therefore God took away all your stuff." And Job keeps trying to tell them, "It doesn't matter to me that my stuff is gone. It matters to me that the relationship is gone." And they don't get that. So at the beginning of chapter 29, when Job is remembering his life as it used to be, he's really not remembering the stuff he used to have. He's remembering the relationship he once had with God. And it is suggested that there is a connection between the way in which he was respected by people and that friendship with God that he had. So that's the thing he misses most. And then it transitions in verse 11 when he continues on. He says, When the ear heard it commended me, and when the eye saw it approved, because I delivered the poor who cried, and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the wretched came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I championed the cause of the stranger. So, this is where Job sort of launches into his defense. And what he basically is responding to are all of the traditional sins that one could be accused of, right? So he's basically saying, was I ever ungenerous to the poor? No, I delivered the poor who cried. Did I ever fail to help the orphans? No, I was the helper to the orphans who had no helper. The wretched people, the most needy people blessed me. Why? Because I helped them. The widow's heart would sing for joy. Why? Because I helped her. I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. So you can hear in the back of this all the echoes of all of these biblical verses throughout Scripture that enjoin us to take care of the poor and the needy and to watch out for the widows and the orphans and the blind and the lame. I mean, we can even hear the echoes of Jesus' words about these things that will come centuries after Job. And so Job is looking at all of those biblical injunctions and all of that stuff in the Jewish law that says you must take care of all of these people, and he's saying, I have taken care of all of these people. Now, it is tempting when you read this part of Job to sort of say, well, he's rather full of himself, isn't he?
Right.
I mean, he's really sort of telling people how wonderful he is. But remember that there's two things we have to keep in mind. First of all, Job is making a legal defense of himself. And so he has to say these things about himself. We live in a system in which we would call character witnesses. And other people would take the stand and would say all of these things about us instead of us saying them ourselves, because it would seem disingenuous for us to say them ourselves. We would have other people say them for us. But in Job's system, there is no such thing as a character witness. He is responsible for giving his own defense, and so he must, and this is what he must do. Secondly, we have to keep in mind that Job, that we as the reader know that Job is correct, right? In the very beginning of the book of Job, it says, God accounts him righteous and holds no sin against him. So we know that when Job says, I did all these things, he is not just being boastful. He really did do all those things. So we would miss the forest for the trees if we were get caught up in the idea that Job is just boasting about himself. He is doing what he has to do to defend himself in court, and we know that he is truthful, and we know that he's correct.
He even spoke with considerable authority because he says, and people were silent after I spoke.
Exactly.
And he, in other words, he in a sense was speaking for God. He had the last word.
In a sense, yes. So he continues on. He says, I broke the fangs of the unrighteous, in verse 17, and made them drop their prey from their teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days like the phoenix. My roots spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches. My glory was fresh with me, and my bow never knew in my hand. So he finishes up saying, I did all these things for those who were in need, as God prescribes us to do. I opposed the unrighteous and the evil, as God enjoins us to do. And because of all that, I thought I would be fine. I thought I would end my days in my nest, right, in my comfortable house. And I would have long years, and I would not have trouble. Because this is what the theology his friends espouse, which Job used to buy into, says. If you do all the right things, God will prosper you, right? That's why, since Job is not prospering currently, all the friends have concluded that he sinned, right? This is the essential problem in Job, the essential theological problem, right? He did not sin, and yet he is suffering, and disaster has befallen him. So he says, I used to think the way you, my friends, thought. I used to think if I did all these things, no harm would come to me. Well, guess what? That was wrong, right? He continues on in verse 21. They listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them like dew. They waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouths as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my countenance did not extinguish. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. So Job is the best possible friend and citizen you could imagine. But now, he says at the beginning of chapter 30, now they make sport of me, those who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. What could I gain from the strength of their hands? All their vigor is gone. Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw the dry and desolate ground. They pick mallow and the leaves of bushes, and to warm themselves the roots of broom. They are driven out from society. People shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of wadis they must live, in holes in the ground and in the rocks. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together, a senseless, disreputable brood. They have been whipped out of the land, and now they mock me in song. I am a byword to them. So he's saying that all the people who are unworthy of Job in his former life, the dregs of society, the people whom he would have looked down on, and we can ask if that's appropriate or not, but they now look down on him, right? The people at the bottom, Job is worse than the people at the bottom. Everyone looks down on him now. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Why has all this happened? Why do they treat me this way? Because God has loosed my bowstring and humbled me. They have cast off restraint at my presence. On my right hand the rabble rise up. They send me sprawling and build roads for my ruin. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. No one restrains them. As though through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. Terrors are turned upon me. My honor is pursued as by the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With violence, he that is God seizes my garment. He grasps me by the collar of my tunic. He has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you, that is to God, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you merely look at me, which is what God has been doing this entire time. Other than the beginning of the book, God is just watching all this unfold. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind. You make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Surely one does not turn against the needy when in disaster they cry for help. Do I not weep for those whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the poor? But when I looked for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and are never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about in sunless gloom. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep. So he says, God, you are treating me worse than I treated the people in need when I was in my former life, right? I did all of these things to be compassionate to the needy, and yet you won't show me any compassion. This is Job's accusation against God, right? In other words, if you expect us as human beings to treat people well, then you ought to be treating us well, right? Where is the justice? Where is the fairness, he says. So Job goes on in chapter 31 to continue to sum up the situation in which he has been placed. The end of that, we won't go through all of chapter 31 because it's sort of rehearsing the same things he's been rehearsing. He does say, we should note at verse 24, he says, if I have made gold my trust or called fine gold my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great or because my hand had gotten much, if I have looked at the sun when it shone or the moon moving in splendor, and my heart had been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand. That's a reference to practicing astrology and worshiping the sun and the moon. This also would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for I should have been false to God above. So in chapter 31, he just goes through, if I had done this, then I would understand why God was punishing me. If I had done this, I would understand why God was punishing me. If I had done that, I would have understand why God was punishing me. So chapter 31 proposes all of these different things he could have done wrong that would have merited what he's experiencing. But of course, he hasn't done those things. He wants us to know, and we know that he hasn't done those things as the readers of the book, right? Even though the friends suppose he must have done something like among these things. And so then we get to the end of chapter 31, the very last line, and it says, the words of Job are ended. Right? He has said his piece. He has said all that he is able to say. And at the beginning of chapter 32, we see that his friends have likewise gone silent. It says, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Now, so that's the poetic way of saying they decided he was so full of himself that there was that he was just not going to listen to them, and so there was nothing more to say.
He just needs to get back on his meds.
Well, yes. he needs to recognize his fault and repent. Even though we know he has nothing to repent for, his friends won't believe that. And they've tried to tell him this over and over again, and they just don't know what else to say to him because he refuses to listen to them. What's interesting is at this point, at verse 2, a new person shows up whom we have never heard of, named Elihu, son of Berechel, the Buzite of the family of Ram. Now, most biblical scholars believe that this section in which Elihu is introduced and in which he speaks was added much later, after the book was completed. Someone went back and added this section. And it's thought that the reason why this section was added was to bring out another type of person who could have opposed Job. So remember that the three friends that we've had up till now, they did great for the first 7 days, right? They just sat in silence with him and in solidarity with him, which was the most useful thing they've done. But once I started speaking, they became useless and not helpful, right? And they spoke from various perspectives. You had the one who spoke about sort of doctrinal purity, and this is what the theology is, and this is what you most has to believe. You have the ones who appeal to sort of the justice of God, and so forth and so on. They speak from different perspectives. Elihu, it is made clear, is a young man. And so he represents the young person who thinks he knows everything, but who in fact knows nothing, right? He is the young person who has learned a lot, but hasn't experienced very much. And he thinks that his learning is more valuable than the experience of his elders, which is typical of most young people, including all of us when we were young. Because we don't understand the value of experience until we've had it, right? And so the picture that is painted is that Elihu, even though he's never been mentioned in this book before, has been sitting there listening to this the whole time. And because he's a young man, it was not his place to speak, because this is a society which is fairly rigidly hierarchical, not only in terms of gender, but also in terms of age. And so your elders were respected and they had the right to speak. The young people did not have the right to speak without their permission, basically, right? So Elihu, he is proposed that he's been sitting there the whole time, even though we've never heard of him, right? And that's made clear in the first few lines here. So it says, this Elihu, he says, he was angry at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He was also angry at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, though they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job, because they were older than he. But when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouths of the three men, he became angry. And so he says, "I am young in years, and you are aged. Therefore I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, 'Let days speak, let many years teach wisdom.' But truly, it is the spirit in a mortal, the breath of the Almighty that makes for understanding. It is not the old that are wise, nor the aged that understand what is right. Therefore I say, 'Listen to me, let me also declare my opinion.'" I mean, you can just imagine the kind of person this is, right? You know, any sort of teenager you want to imagine, right? "I know more than you do. I learned this thing. What do you know?" And these are the chapters that we're going to skip over. And the reason for that is that Elihu has absolutely nothing new to say. Everything that Elihu says has been said by the three friends already, right? Elihu does the exact same thing that all of them have been doing, right? He assumes that the calamity that has befallen Job has befallen him because he has sinned in some way that he refuses to recognize. He praises the almightiness of God, which we've seen the friends do, even though the way in which Job praises God is always more profound and deeper than the ways the friends praise God. Elihu, like the three other friends, is speaking based on things he's learned, but it's clear that he has no actual experience of a relationship with God, just as it's clear that the friends have no actual experience of a relationship with God. And if there is one of the very consistent themes that is ever present in this book, that experience of God trumps theology about God each and every time. And so Elihu has nothing new to add. He goes on. He goes on for like five chapters. But he, and you can just see them all sitting there sort of like this, you know, with their hands on their chins going, "Oh my God, will you just shut up?" Because there's nothing new that he has to offer. So finally, at the end of chapter 37, Elihu does shut up. And it's at that point that the second and final climax of the book arrives. The first sort of climax of the book was when Job sort of hit bottom, right? And the bottom fell out of his life completely, and he begins to question what in the world is going on, right? The second climax, which arrives at the beginning of chapter 38, is when God finally has something to say to all of this. And as I mentioned a moment ago, remember, God has been silent throughout almost this entire book, other than the setup at the beginning. It's as if God has just been watching. And now God has something to say. So at the beginning of chapter 38, it says, "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." Now, that's interesting, Rohr thinks. Because you remember back in the Old Testament, there's the story about the prophet Ezekiel, I think it's Ezekiel, isn't it? Who hides from God because he's fed up. And God goes and looks for him and says, "Where the heck are you?" And says, "Come out and talk to me." And it says, there was the sound of great wind rushing, right? And then there was sound of earthquake. And then there was the sound of fire and all this kind of stuff. And it says God was in none of this. And then it says there was the sound of sheer silence. And it's out of the sound of sheer silence that God speaks. Well, that is not the case here. God speaks out of a whirlwind, which could be anything from a big dust devil to a tornado, right? Rohr does not think this is accidental, because Rohr thinks that the whirlwind out of which God speaks in Job is meant to represent the dynamism and the energy and the movement the constant movement of the divine. You can't put a whirlwind in a box, right? You can't capture it. You can't tame it. And that is exactly what Job's friends have done, Rohr suggests. They have boxed up God in their nice, neat theology. And they have decided that, therefore, there are no more questions. It's all settled. And because it is clear that these three friends have knowledge of God but no experience of God, the suggestion is that because they have boxed God up in their nice, neat theology, they are no longer able to actually have contact with God, because God cannot get past their theology, and they can't get past their theology either. So Rohr thinks that the fact that God speaks out of a whirlwind is meant to be a direct counter to the way in which the friends have sort of fixed God in place. They've captured God, they think. The whirlwind signifies that God cannot be captured. So Job hears God speak to him out of the whirlwind. And God says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me." So, when we got to this chapter 38 and we found out that God was about to speak, we were like, "Yay, answers! We're going to get answers now." And what does God say? "I will question you." What? We were waiting for this whole book to get answers, and now we're going to get questions? This is not what we were looking for, right? This is annoying. But this is how God shows up. Interesting, isn't it? That God shows up not as the provider of answers, but as the asker of questions. And the questions that God is about to ask are deep questions indeed. And this whole book of Job is considered a masterpiece of Hebrew poetry. These chapters where God speaks are profound and sublime examples of Hebrew poetry. They are magnificent and they are beautiful. So God shows up to ask the questions. Where we thought there were going to be answers, now there are just going to be questions. So here are the questions God begins to ask at verse 4 of chapter 38. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy." So, be aware that this speech of God reflects the cosmology of the people of Job's time, right? So the earth is flat and it's built on pillars and so forth. Do not get lost in that cosmology, or you will lose the forest for the trees, right? This is not meant to be a scientific description of creation. It is meant to be a poetic description of creation, right? So let's not get lost in the cosmology. He goes on at verse 8. He says, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped." Now, think about how you feel when you stand before the ocean. Do you feel big or small? Sally's going like this. You feel small, right? Because we are awed by the power of the ocean, right? It is this massive, powerful thing. And when it's stormy and the clouds are dark and the waves are moving, it's even more powerful. And indeed, in certain circumstances, can be terrifying, right? There are many examples of people on the coast of California who get grabbed by the sea and pulled in, right? But notice here, God talks about the sea as if it were a child. "I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. Remember Jesus and the swaddling clothes? Right? I prescribe bounds for it. Set doors and bars like we do for a toddler. This far you shall go, child, and no farther. Right? It is meant to suggest that as a little child is to us, so is the sea to God. Now think about that. Think about how we experience the sea as this immensely powerful force. God is way, way, way beyond that, right? So if the sea is to God as a little child is to us, it raises the question, and what are we compared to God, right? So in a sense, this entire speech on God's part is an exercise to put Job and with him all of humanity in its place, right? So he continues at verse 12. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal and it is dyed like a garment. Light is withheld from the wicked and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. So he's sort of mocking Job in a way, right? You think you know so much. Well, then answer all these questions about the mysteries of creation, right? Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home? Surely you know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Right? This is sort of the mocking part, right? Yeah, Job, you were around when all this got started, weren't you? You know all about it, don't you? Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no one lives, on the desert which is empty of human life, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the ground put forth grass? Now notice, in these words, God speaks of rain landing where no one lives and the desert which is empty of human life. So one of the things that questions that God's response to Job raises is it questions the tendency of human beings to assume that everything is all about us. If you read the Genesis story of creation, it contains with it a kind of assumption that all of this is for us. All the creation is designed with us in mind. We are the center of everything. This response on God's part to Job sort of suggests the opposite, that we are not the center of everything, that God has concern with things that have nothing to do with us, like the places where we don't live, right? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the hoarfrost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades, or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maserat in their season? Or can you guide the bear with its children? These are references to constellations, of course. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule upon the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings so that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts and given understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to number the clouds? Or who can tilt the waterskins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods cling together? Can you hunt the prey of the lion? Or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their covert? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? So here's an idea. Other creatures have relationships with God too, not just human beings, right? God has not just us to listen to. God has all of creation to be concerned with. Chapter 39. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch to give birth to their offspring and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go forth and do not return to them. Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass, to which I have given the steppe for its home, the salt land for its dwelling place? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its pasture, and it searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will it spend the night at your crib? Can you tie it in the furrow with ropes, or will it harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on it because its great strength is great, and will you hand over your labor to it? Do you have faith in it that it will return and bring your grain to your threshing floor? The ostrich's wings flap wildly, though its pinions lack plumage, for it leaves its egg to the earth, and it lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that a wild animal may trample them. So one of the interesting things about God's responses to Job is in sort of putting Job and all of humanity in this larger context of the rest of creation, mention is made of animals that to human beings seem ridiculous. Like what use is there for a bird that can't fly, which is what he's just described the ostrich as being? What use is there for a stupid bird that can't make a nest in a tree and has to put its eggs in the ground, right? These things seem useless to us, right? But God is saying they are all part of it, right? What seems useless to you, its uselessness to you is what's not important. What's important is that I made it, and it is a part of creation. It deals cruelly with its young as if they were not its own, though its labor should be in vain. Yet it has no fear, because God has made it forget wisdom and given it no share in understanding. When it spreads its plumes aloft, it laughs at the horse and its rider. The ostrich doesn't need wisdom. It just lives its life, right? It doesn't wonder about why its life is the way it is. It just accepts the givenness of its existence, right? Do you give the horse its might? Do you clothe its neck with mane? Do you make it leap like the locust? Its majestic snorting is terrible. It paws violently, exults mightily. It goes out to meet the weapons. It laughs at fear and is not dismayed. It does not turn back from the sword. Upon it rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage it swallows the ground. It cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, it says, "Aha!" From a distance it smells the battle, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars and spreads its wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes its nest on high? It lives on the rock and makes its home in the fastness of the rocky crag. From there it spies the prey, its eyes see it from far away, its young ones suck up blood, and there the slain are. There it is. And where the slain are, there it is. So God has held forth for a bit. Chapter 40 begins, and Job says, and the Lord continues, he says, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Anyone who argues with God must respond." So he's saying to Job, okay, you want an argument? I'll give you an argument. What do you got to say to this? And Job answered the Lord, "See, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, I will not answer, twice, but will proceed no further." Now, does it seem to you Job gives up rather easily? I mean, he has spent this entire book ranting about all of this and demanding an explanation. And God finally shows up with no answers and only questions. And Job says, "Great. Put my hand on my mouth. I got nothing more to say."
Just the anger in that, not giving up.
Uh-huh. So, interesting, Rohr doesn't see that. What Rohr sees is Job's immense relief that God has finally started talking. And in Job's response, Rohr sees an indication that Job really wasn't ever looking for answers. What he was looking was for the restoration of relationship. He just needed God to say something. The friends would want answers. But Rohr suggests that what Job really wants is just the relationship to begin. So Job doesn't want to say a whole lot because he doesn't want God to stop talking. He suddenly has the relationship back. God has stepped toward him again. And he just wants that to go on and on and on. So he says, I'm not going to say anything, God. You just keep on going. Because I've been trying to get you to say something for days now. Right? So the Lord continues at verse 6 of chapter 40. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you will declare to me. So it's this formula that God uses to begin these speeches. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like his? Deck yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on all who are proud and abase them. Look on all who are proud and bring them low. Tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then I will also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can give you victory. So God is suggesting that whatever victory, quote unquote, Job or anyone else may have, they have because of God, not because of their own strength. And then he goes into this interesting thing where he talks about two creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan. Behemoth is a hippopotamus, and Leviathan is a crocodile. Only the hippopotami that we and Job would have known are understood to be descendants of the great hippo known as Behemoth, who is a symbol for evil and chaos. And the crocodile is understood to be a descendant of Leviathan, which was another creature, a mythical creature that personified chaos. And so hippos and crocodiles in Job's time were seen as animals who had no use to human beings. They were powerful animals. They were not animals that could be tamed. They had mythical connections to these mythical creatures. And so God chooses to meditate upon these two mythical creatures and their descendants. Look at Behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Its strength is in its loins and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are knit together. Its bones are tubes of bronze, its limbs like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. For the mountains yield food for it, where all the wild animals play. Under the lotus plants it lies, in the covert of the reeds and in the marsh. The lotus trees cover it for shade. The willows of the wadi surround it. Even if the river is turbulent, it is not frightened. It is confident, though Jordan rushes against its mouth. Can one take it with hooks or pierce its nose with a snare? Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it make many supplications to you? Will it speak soft words to you? Will it make a covenant with you to be taken as your servant forever? Will you play with it as with a bird, or will you put it on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over it? Will they divide it up among the merchants? Can you fill its skin with harpoons or its head with fishing spears? Lay hands on it. Think of the battle. You will not do it again. And hope of capturing it will be disappointed. Were not even the gods overwhelmed by the sight of it? No one is so fierce as to dare to stir it up. Who can stand before it? Who can confront it and be safe? Under the whole heaven, who? The answer is only I. I will not keep silence concerning its limbs or its mighty strength or its splendid frame. Who can strip off its outer garment? Who can penetrate its double coat of mail? Who can open the doors of its face? There is terror all around its teeth. Its back is made of shields and rows, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. Its sneezes flash forth light, and its eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. From its mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap out. Out of its nostrils comes smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. Its breath kindles coals, and a flame comes out of its mouth. In its neck abides strength, and terror dances before it. The folds of its flesh cling together. It is firmly cast and immovable. Its heart is as hard as stone, as hard as the lower millstone. When it raises itself up, the gods are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches it, it does not avail, nor does the spear, the dart, or the javelin. It counts iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make it flee. Sling stones for it are turned to chaff. Clubs are counted as chaff. It laughs at the rattle of javelins. Its underparts are like shot-part shards. It spreads itself like a threshing sledge on the mire. It makes the deep boil like a pot. It makes the sea like a pot of ointment. It leaves a shining wake behind it. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth it has no equal, a creature without fear. It surveys everything that is lofty. It is king over all that are proud. So, all of this speeching on God's part is meant to sort of put Job, and with him the rest of humanity, in a larger context. That is, the context of all creation. And to point out that there is so much that Job and human beings do not know about creation and how it got here and how it works. Now, we know much more about it than Job did, right? Because of science, right? But think of the context that we know, right? Have you ever seen that picture? It comes up on Facebook and places like that once in a while, that has this whole picture of all these little tiny lights of various sizes. And there's a little arrow pointing to a little tiny dot in the midst of all these little points of light. And it says, you are here. Right? It's a picture of the galaxy. Not even the universe. Just a galaxy. With this little arrow that says, you are here, right? Which reminds us that we are infinitesimally small compared to the vastness of the universe, right? Well, Job didn't know about the vastness of the universe, but he knew about the vastness of creation. To him, the world was as vast as the universe seems to us. And God is saying, is putting him in the context of all of this vastness and saying, who are you compared to all of this? And what do you know about all of this? And is pointing out that God has a relationship with this whole vast creation in ways that human beings do not understand. There are apparently useless animals that exist, and we have no reason, no idea why they exist. The biblical implication is that they are there because God delights in their existence, right? And so God answers Job's questions by putting him in the context of the larger creation and basically asking the question, you think you know so much. Well, think about all of this and then tell me, what is it that you really know? And so Job answers in verse at the beginning of chapter 42. He says, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I do not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. So see, he's repeating the formula God used with him. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, Rohr suggests that when we read this line, I heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, that we can hear the echoes of a later writer, which is St. Paul, who said, now I see in a mirror dimly, then I shall see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. And this is kind of the book of Job's way of saying the same thing, right? And but it does it in a way that says, that compares, as we've seen throughout this book, learning with experience, right? Job says, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear. That's what the friends have been doing the whole time, yeah. Right? But now I see you. My eyes see you. But there is an implication, Rohr suggests, to Job being able to say, now I see you. And that implication is that Job is also now seen. And Rohr suggests that this is really what Job, the deepest thing that Job desires. Job desires to be seen as he is. And when you think about it, the only one who is able to see us as we are, without overly magnifying our faults or overly diminishing them, is God. And this in the end, is the healing capacity of our relationship with God, which no amount of knowledge about God will confer. Because when we know ourselves to be seen by God, when God sees us in absolute truth and authenticity, without any prejudice, and welcomes us as beloved children of God, then that confers on us a kind of freedom that allows us to be healed of whatever it is we need to be healed from. Because we are no longer afraid of moving toward that healing. Unfortunately, the church has done a terrible job over the centuries, most of the time, of presenting this truth to people. Because we have encouraged people, or allowed people, to believe that when God looks at them, God sees mostly everything that's wrong with them. And that makes people terrified of God. Or at least resentful. And this is the way the three friends have presented God to Job. That God looks upon Job and sees his fault and therefore punishes him. And what the book of Job is saying at the end here is that no. That is not the truth. The truth is God sees us as we are. When we suppose that God over-exaggerates our faults, then we can't be healed because we're just locked up in guilt and a sense of unworthiness. Or we're so ticked off with God at being so focused on what's wrong with us, we really want nothing to do with God. At the same time, however, the church has also sometimes gone in the other direction, especially more recently, and said, oh, you're fine. You're fine. God loves you just as you are. You don't need to change a thing. You're totally, totally fine. Well, when we do that, there's also no room for healing because there's no room for growth because we've said you have nothing to fix. Everybody has things to fix. Everybody has places where they need to grow. So underestimating those growth places cuts the growth off. Overemphasizing the growth places cuts the growth off. This is what we human beings tend to do. We either look upon each other with rose-colored glasses, or more often we look upon each other with terrible judgment. And in either case, we don't actually see the truth of the person in front of us. At least we don't see it fully. We see it as in a mirror, dimly. God sees it face to face. And Rohr suggests that this, in the end, is what we most deeply long for, to be seen exactly as we are. Because that's the only place where liberation and salvation and healing happen. And the implication of Job saying, "I now see you," is that he is also now seen. The relationship is reestablished. God has stepped back toward him. Job knows once again that he abides in God's loving gaze. And that's what he's wanted this entire time.
Is this one of the few times in the Bible that God is accusatory?
Oh, no. Not at all.
Because I think of God as being a gentle, loving God.
You should read the Old Testament more.
Read the Old Testament
more. Yeah, exactly.
And I would argue that I don't well, I would say this. I do not receive this speech that God has made as being unloving. I see it as being deeply truthful. And sometimes truth can sound unloving because we don't really want to receive it, right? The only thing God is doing in this speech is pointing out that creation is much, much bigger than Job is. And that Job is doing what most human beings do, intending to think that all of this is about him. And God is saying, it's not about you. You're a part of it. But it's all much bigger than you. And there is so much you don't understand about it. And you are not really in a position to question why I am the way who I am, why things are the way they are, until you understand the whole. And this is the other implication of the divine seeing, right? Just as God is the only one who sees us as we truly are, God is also the only one who sees the whole of everything. Job is sort of assailing God for the circumstances of his particular life without being able to see the whole. And God is simply pointing out to him the whole. But God is not done with Job yet. We must point out, Job said, "I despise myself, therefore I put in dust and ashes." We should not take that too literally. Job doesn't hate himself. He's making a statement of humility before the mystery of God, right? That's what that is about. So the end of chapter 42. The Lord turns his attention from Job to Job's friends and says, "After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.'" So it's interesting, right? Because even though God has just put Job in his place, he's also said it's perfectly appropriate that Job asked all those questions. And he's saying to the friends, all of your answers were rubbish. "Now, therefore," he says, "take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has done." Now notice that the friends have been useless to Job. And all they have done is magnify his pain. And now what does God say Job must do? It actually doesn't say that. What does it say he must do?
Pray for them.
Oh. Right? He must pray for them. Which suggests that the tension introduced into their relationship, and perhaps even the breaking apart of their relationship because of their the role they played in trying to comfort him and only magnified his pain. God will not allow that. It's not okay that that continue. It has to be repaired. Therefore, Job must pray for his friends. And they must also make an offering. So, to the degree that they have stepped away from each other over the course of this dialogue, they must now step back toward each other in the same way God has stepped toward Job. So it's not okay just to condemn the friends as useless and be done with them. Has to find a way to stay in relationship with them. Which suggests that it's not okay for us to throw away our relationship with God because it gets frustrating for us. We have to find a way to stay in it, even when it becomes hard. And so it says that Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, notice that Elihu has disappeared again, further reinforcing the idea that he was a later addition to the story. They went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends. Notice, the fortunes don't get restored until the praying for the friends has been done. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then there came to him all his brothers and his sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him in his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them had gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He named the first Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Karen Hapuk, which I sorely regret not naming Madeline. In all the land, there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance along with their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his children's children, 4 generations, and Job died old and full of days. Right at the end here is slipped in something quite revolutionary. First of all, the daughters of Job are named and not the sons. This is an overturning of biblical precedent when it's the male heirs who count and not the daughters. The second revolutionary thing is that Job gave his daughters a share in the inheritance. This was not the custom at the time. Only sons inherited property, not daughters. So the fact that the daughters are named and that they are given a share of the inheritance suggests that Job was an enlightened man indeed, and perhaps recognized what all of this pointing out of God's relationship to the larger creation and not just to human beings was in part intended to convey, which is the value of everything and of everyone, because everything and everyone is part of the whole. And in the end, the irony of the story of Job is twofold. The irony on the first hand is that God never answers Job's questions directly, never explains to Job why this all happened. And the second is that Job's friends, who were useless at comforting him and whose theology was deeply flawed because they said that if Job only repented, that Job was in the situation because of sin, and if he only repented, he would be restored. He does get all the stuff back in the end, just as his friends promised him he would. But the thing to always bear in mind is that that was not what Job was looking for. What Job was looking for was the reestablishment of relationship. He was looking for God to see him and for him to feel himself and know himself as having been seen. And it's the restoration of that relationship that gives Job joy, not the restoration of the stuff. The stuff was a nice thing, but it's not the thing that mattered most to Job. So, We're out of time for today. So we will regather 2 weeks from today, as I said before. And we finished with the book, so we have nothing more to read in Job. But I want to invite you just to sit with the ending of the book of Job for the next couple of weeks. To sit with that ending versus the questions that Job raised. To sit with the ending versus the questions that you have about what the heck happens to people in life and why. And look at how does this ending of Job relate to your own questions? How does it relate to Job's questions? How does it relate to your questions? Where does it leave you on this question that is so central to the human experience? Why does bad stuff happen to us? And then we'll talk about that next week. And I'm sure we will reach a decisive and resolutionary conclusion that we can loose upon the world.